Hey everyone, you might remember me from Teen Mom 2, but my 15 minutes is almost up. So I'm back with another podcast. I'm your barely famous host, Kale Lowry, and I'm catching up with people from my past, putting my exes on the hot seat, and chatting with TikTokers, influencers, and other reality stars. Get weird with me every Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podcast One, or wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the best things you can do for your health, of course, is to get at least 7 hours of quality sleep every night. It's hard to get that much sleep. Your mind keeps you awake. Your schedule doesn't allow it. Hundreds of reasons why we don't get adequate sleep. But it's super important. And, of course, your body heals. Your brain resets and heals and clears itself of, these things that accumulate that we use sleep to clear it for. And if you're not getting enough sleep, you're increasing your risk of various diseases, also making it harder to lose weight. Well, an easy way to get more quality sleep, make sure you're getting enough magnesium. Believe it or not, around 75% of people do not get enough, which explains some of the problem. Unfortunately, most magnesiums are not full spectrum. They won't fix the deficiency or help you sleep better. There are actually 7 unique forms of magnesium. You need to get all of them to experience the full benefits. Magnesium Breakthrough by Bioptimizers provides that. Simply take 2 capsules before you go to bed and see what you think. And I suspect you'll be more rested when you wake up. For an exclusive offer for our listeners, go to magbreakthrough.com/Drew to save up to 42%. Again, 42% on Mag Breakthrough when you go to magbreakthrough, MAGBREAKTHROUGH, magbreakthrough.com/Drew.
Symbiotica is a health supplement company designing sophisticated formulations that are proven to increase vitality and improve nutritional health overall. I use several of their products. Symbiotica's liposomal magnesium L3-8, developed by a team of scientists. Symbiotica's Super Green, a convenient way to boost your daily nutrition as well. Liposomal vitamin C, a synergistic formula that plays a key role in immune function. You've heard me talk about that during the COVID crisis, of course. And they've got a D3K2 CoQ10 product. I use that literally every day. Take their online quiz to figure out the best supplement for your healthcare needs. And if you use code Drew at Symbiotica.com, you'll get 15%. And if you use code Drew at Symbiotica.com, you'll get 15% off site-wide. Or you can create your own custom bundle and get up to 45% off. That is at Cymbiotica, Symbiotica, Cymbiotica.com. 15% off with code Drew and 45% off if you generate your own custom bundle.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Dr. Drew Podcast. Appreciate you all being here. Appreciate you supporting the people that support us. Appreciate you also checking out some of the other stuff we're doing. DrDrew.tv for the streaming show. Some interesting guests there. I may bring the present guest around over to that show as well one of these days very soon. And check me out at Dr. Dupinsky on Instagram. And we're over there on TikTok a bit as well. Today, I'm privileged to welcome Whitney Goodman. Her book is Toxic Positivity, Keeping It Real in a World Obsessed with Being Happy. We're going to talk about happiness and its misconceptions and the extraordinary preoccupations we have with this stuff as opposed to leading a good life, which has been my point. Whitney's Instagram is at sitwithwit, W-H-I-T, website sitwithwit.com. Counseling Center website is collabcounselingcenter.com. Again, Whitney Goodman, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So talk a little bit about your training and then how you got into this particular topic, because I'm sure you had to tell that story many times. So let's kind of start out with that.
Sure. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. I work mainly with individuals that are dealing with relationship issues, particularly with family, siblings, partners, things like that. I noticed very early on in my career, I was working with patients and family members who are dealing with cancer, that there was this immense pressure to be happy and everything sort of hinged on being happy, survival, our health, our wellness, all of that. And it was very hard for me to buy into. And the more I started having these conversations with people in my office, friends, family, I picked up on the fact that a lot of us were really struggling with this demand to be positive all the time. And it seemed like we're looking for a different way out.
Let's talk about happiness. And I noticed one of the things I like about how you frame things, you tend to gravitate towards positivity rather than happiness, which I think is an important move. From my perspective, and you tell me if you agree with this or not, in this country, when we talk about happiness, we don't even know what the F we're talking about. We don't even know what we mean anymore. And happiness is something that has been discussed all the way back to Aristotle. And we even mischaracterized in sort of recent literature discussions about Aristotle's position. We even defined what he was calling as happiness. He didn't even mean what we thought he meant because we had such a bias towards Yahoo happiness and euphoria. But I'll let you hear your thoughts on that.
I totally agree. I think we have no idea what we're talking about. And it's become this amorphous concept that we're always chasing. And it's been very commercialized, right? Mm-hmm. Happiness is now a commodity that you can purchase or get with whatever new thing you're doing. And I think positivity is very different from happiness, especially when we're talking about toxic positivity. That is a totally different concept than trying to infuse more happiness in your life.
It's interesting to me that you came to this through cancer, because I could see, I don't know if I would argue this or not, but I could see where we started down this path by hiding illness and death behind hospitals and the medical profession. And we still do it to this day. I mean, I think people are getting a little better than sort of when I started practicing medicine in the 80s and 90s, it was you couldn't get people to even address aging, let alone dying. They wouldn't do it. There was no palliative care yet. Everything was going to the mat for everybody all the time. And it created a huge distortion about the nature of the human condition. Do you agree with that?
For sure. And now I think it has shifted. When I was working with cancer, there was sort of this new thing of like the mind-body connection. And we're talking about that a lot more now. And, and yes, there's a lot of validity to that. There's a lot of new research. But I saw it being taken to the extreme, especially with these specific people, where it's like, if you're not happy and positive, you're going to die. Your treatment's not going to work.
Yes, I agree.
And horrible. That's horrible. Not necessarily true.
That's horrible. Yes. It's terrible.
Exactly.
It's terrible. So, so we are deeply aligned on this issue. Before I let you talk more about what Keeping It Real is all about, which is your book, I want to do a little more on happiness versus finally, I've noticed people are at least dividing happiness into eudaimonic happiness, which is sort of a more nurturing quality that isn't necessarily feel good, and hedonic happiness, which is about euphoria, which is what my heroin addicts indulge in. And when I first started seeing so much stuff about happiness in the 90s, I was thinking, hey, guys, this is way off. There's no one happier than my heroin addicts when they get their first hit. That's Yahoo euphoria, happy. They are not leading a good life. They are not happy in any sense of being fulfilled or, you know, the million other aspects to eudaimonic happiness that we at the time were missing and continue to miss to this day. Do you agree with that differentiation between hedonic tone and eudaimonic? And want to talk a little bit about that?
Yes. I think a lot of people have this sense that if they're doing happiness right, they're feeling that hedonic state all the time, right? They're feeling joyful and all of that. And what I really argue in my book and try to push through my work is more this idea of, you said, fulfillment and living in line with our values and knowing that we're probably not going to feel good all the time when we're pursuing the things that matter to us, but we feel much more grounded and in line with our values.
And I would call that, sort of loosely speaking, a good life, right? Leading a good life. When I talk to people about this, I go, do you think Jesus was happy all the time? Do you think he felt great about what was going on? But did he lead a good life? And a good life doesn't feel good, and sometimes it feels bad, but it still has a, I don't know whether word to use, but status or a sort of a position that naturally is superior to just hedonic happiness, which, again, back to my heroin addicts, they're happy right away. And we seem to have lost track of the good life. And again, when I say the good life, they start immediately think, people in this country start thinking about, oh, you get to live at the beach, you have lots of money, that's the good life. No, that's not what we're talking about. So talk to me about Keeping It Real in a World Obsessed with Happy.
So I think we have to move away from this constant pursuit of happiness and really get back to this middle road of, like, you're talking about the good life, and I talk a lot about the good enough life, of thinking about what matters to me, what's fulfilling, and also how can I be authentic about my experience and not try to suppress and hide everything bad that I'm going through, and also put on this sort of like fake performance that we see often, like on social media, or our outward expression of how we're feeling and how different that is from what we're actually feeling inside.
From a psychodynamic perspective, because you're working with people on a deeper level when you close the door, what is underlying most of that? Is there a common kind of phenomenon in this detachment from authenticity?
I think a lot of people feel a deep sense of shame for feeling how they're feeling. And there's this sense of, like, I shouldn't be feeling like that. I shouldn't be struggling. I should be okay. And I think now that we're living in a world where, like, we sort of have an avatar of ourselves and then our real selves, and there's such a disconnect there that it's hard to live authentically. You're always opening yourself up for judgment or criticism when you put that out there.
So when I think about people that are prone to shame, I think about abandonment and adverse childhood experiences. So I'm guessing that's the underpinning that, of course, everyone refuses to talk about. But why don't you talk about it?
Yeah. I would say the majority of the people I work with that have trouble expressing their feelings, talking about their feelings, validating themselves, grew up in homes where that was not allowed. It was not modeled for them, or they were punished or shamed for having any of those types of normal human experiences. And so it takes a long time to get out of that mode and to really convince yourself, like, hey, I'm allowed to have these types of feelings and express them.
So I was one of these people that was fairly disconnected from affect. And for me, as I've seen for many of my patients and many other people, you can't rewire that connection without having an other, meaning a trained person ideally, sit and hold the frame for you and reflect back to you a million times as you rebuild those connections. I'm sure that's sort of the work you do, right? Is that accurate? Yeah.
Yes.
And that's absolutely. It's in a way that's kind of trauma therapy in a way. I mean, it's not specific trauma therapy because, you know, it's not EMDR or something like that, but it's emotionally focused therapy. Would you agree with that? Is that what it is? Yeah. Is it proper to characterize it that way as EFT or is a kind of an EFT?
Kind of, I guess.
Okay. Yeah.
I think it would probably have a lot of overlaps with different types of therapies.
Yes. Agreed. How did you come to this?
Come to this realization of,
come to
of
this
figuring out that was a problem.
Both the realization you said through cancer patients, but also I'm guessing your technique adjusted at the same time. And so I'm just wondering what your story was with this.
Absolutely. So oddly enough, social media played a huge role in me kind of coming to this and changing my style as a therapist. I was definitely trained in this, like, be a blank slate. Don't show up fully as a human being. And it wasn't until I started talking with clients and showing up online that I realized people actually want more of that authenticity. They want the therapist to say, like, what's going on? You know, what's the problem here? Let's really talk about it and get honest about what you're feeling, and also express, like, hey, I deal with this too. No one is perfect. No one's immune to that.
Yeah. And I'm trying to think of what technically is going on between you and the client. It's interpersonal analysis. It's interpersonal psychotherapy, right? It's just plain old you engage in something called a relationship, and that relationship is held in a safe environment, and you're there. There's one person wanting help, and you're there helping. And that's the fundamental part.
Right. Yeah. And I think just modeling that as well, that, like, you can share this with me and I'm going to safely receive it, hold it, and not meet you with judgment or criticism.
Are you familiar with Peter Fonagy, his stuff?
I'm not.
Mentalizing. He's the mentalizing guy. He invented that whole exchange. Okay. And it's really, he sort of operationalized this exchange that you were talking about, you know, what actually is going on when one person's doing that to the other. And it is essentially calling upon two things, I think, and you tell me if this is accurate. attachment mechanisms. You're sort of re-equilibrating insecure or ambivalent attachments, and allowing for something they used to call rapprochement, where you become the secure base, because therapy happens in real time. It happens in the context of living. And so that person gets to go out into the world and they come back to you with material for a secure attachment and processing of that material. Is that the basic mechanism?
Absolutely. I think that that's what I strive to provide through my work, is like, this is always the place that you can come back to and work on that attachment and see that you're able to form those types of attachments. And then people are able to recreate those out in the real world.
And do you notice, I've read some literature once a while ago that suggested that if an individual can form a secure attachment, typically it requires a professional to really navigate that, because it's when you're insecure, you do things in your relationships subconsciously, and the therapist interferes with that by creating secure attachments. It gets translated out into the primary attachments like spouses and, you know, close relationships, and those become more secure. And those people change a little bit too. Do you find that to be true?
That's something I believe in very strongly, and I find that to be true anecdotally through my work, absolutely.
I don't feel like a lot of mental health professionals are doing what you do. am I wrong?
You know what? I think there's been a big push towards like manualized treatment, CBT, very focused
yes.
on like a specific thing.
Yes.
That because I come from like a systems lens as a family therapist, I'm mainly working in that realm. I would bet that it's quite different.
It bothers me not to diminish the efficacy of CBT, because it does help. It just mm-hmm. misses the richness of the stuff we're talking about, which are really changes who we are, not in a fundamental way in terms of our personality function, but fundamentally in terms of our, like we began talking about, our authenticity, the things we connect with, the sort of primary affects. Let me ask you this. I'm going to throw a provocative question out there, and I'm trying to decide if I'm going to lead the witness or not. I'm going to lead you a little bit. It's hard enough to have a single attachment, right? It's hard to get people to have a single, secure, good attachment. What do we do with all these people going, I just have many polyamorous, whatever, and I have many, and I love everybody, and blah, 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 blah. What do you do with those people? My approach, by the way, has just been, live your best life. Good. If it works for you, fine. But I know for sure,
yeah.
I know for sure it's not because of the work people like you do. But you tell me what we do with it.
So my approach as a clinician to anyone that comes with me with whatever it is I want to know, how is this impacting your life and what problems is it causing you? And if people tell me this isn't causing any problems in my life, I don't think it's an issue for me, I don't really see it to be my job to tell them that it is. I may just gently point out, like, well, you brought this up or that. Do you think it could be related to this?
But at the end of the day,
people get to choose.
But you're dealing with rigid, abject denial is what you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And sometimes mm-hmm. you have to kind of pierce that a little bit. Whether they want to work on it is
sure.
up to them. But
right.
I found a lot of therapeutic wonderment is helpful. Geez, you keep talking about the conflicts with the other sister wives. You never get to see your primary. You seem lonely. Just, I wonder what that's about.
Right. Sure. Absolutely.
Because I welcome people to give it a try if that's what they want to do. But it's hard enough to get two people to connect. It's impossible. You spend your whole career
yeah.
doing it. It's impossible. You have to. It's like unwinding a spool of thread and then turning it into an origami, you know, character. It's really complicated. You know.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's definitely an area that I don't see a lot of in my own office.
Yeah.
So I don't have a ton of experience with it.
Okay. I've been leading you along through all this. tell me more what's interesting to you, what you like people to know about toxic positivity.
Sure. I think for me, the real message behind why I wanted to write this book was that I think we lose out on so much connection, and we've been talking about attachment and forming bonds, when we reject how other people are feeling or tell them to put a happy smile or a positive spin on something. And so that's what I really want to encourage people to do, is to try to learn how to sit with people when they're in distress.
It's hard.
And not fix it or put a spin on it. It is really hard. And just to say, like, that sucks. That sounds hard.
So really what we're talking about is boundaries, right? And a willingness to sit with uncomfortable things. That helps us establish boundaries, just doing that. But this tendency to want to rescue, I think one of the major – well, I know I suffered from this. One of the major motivating factors in people wanting to rescue other people is not just that it's uncomfortable to see other people in distress, but it mobilizes our own pain. And we start to confuse their pain and our pain. And for somebody with boundary issues and codependency and things like that, these things are extremely vague and difficult to tease out if you're not having treatment. And again, I'm someone that has experienced both sides of this. And trust me, having been through treatment, much more effective at sitting and being present with somebody, much more effective. If I, prior to therapy, had tried to sit with somebody, I'm not sure I could have been fully present. I would have dissociated. I would have rescued. I would have something. Something would have gone off because my boundaries were porous. So how do you coach somebody up who's like I was?
Yeah, so I definitely struggled with that too, especially early on in my career. And yeah. I think it takes a lot of work to learn, like, I can't save this person. And sometimes my motivations for wanting to do that are actually quite selfish.
Mm-hmm. But you don't see it. You can't see it. It's on such a deep level. Right. You can't see it. You don't know it's your pain. It's just pain. You just see the pain in the other person. And again, personally, I experienced myself sort of through other people a lot. And so it just seemed like their pain, but for years and years of therapy, you realize, oh shit, that's really my pain that's got to tease out there. So go ahead.
I feel like you have to really work on moving out of this mindset of that, like, I am the fixer, I am the helper, and more like I am the person that is walking alongside this person in their journey, in their process. And that just means, like, I'm a witness. I'm somebody that can offer insight, but I am not the expert on their lived experience. I am not the fixer. And that takes a lot of practice, but I think it also frees us up from a lot of the pressure that comes with trying to fix and save people and continuously failing at that because it doesn't work.
Right. That is true. But let's talk to – how would we coach up a friend of somebody who just is dealing with grief, a major loss? I think we can use a little cognitive stuff here with some basic ABCs of how to approach and then – try to stay cool with your boundaries, which is the harder part.
Yeah. I think if you have someone that's going through loss, my first thing is to try to meet the person where they're at and seek understanding, right? So what is this like for you? What are you experiencing? And that's also a great way to bring yourself out of the fixing role, is more just like, I want to learn about their experience instead of trying to find solutions. And then of course, validation and compassion of, that sounds hard. I really feel for what you're going through. This is a difficult situation. And from there, thinking about what is my skill set best suited for to help this person? And also, what kind of help are they asking for? We often want to help just in the ways that we think are good, but instead asking what would be helpful for you and trying to set boundaries around that and also mobilize our action in that area.
I find that usually they will just say, I just need you to be here.
Mm-hmm. That's 100% of the time.
Yeah, that's sort of the most common thing. And in terms of being here, they don't mean be here and tell me things are going to be better. They specifically don't mean that because they're not. It sucks. It's hard. And just to really just sort of nod and be as present as you can be is really more meaningful than anything. And then again, there's things you can do to help people that are struggling. You can get them food, you can help them clean the house, you can do things. And that's important too.
Yeah. I think for anyone that's been in therapy, there have been sessions I have with people at the end that they're like, wow, that was so helpful. And I'm like, gosh, I don't really do much of anything except kind of like nod, listen to you, make eye contact. And just that presence, that uninterrupted presence, is so huge for people.
There's another thing that Fonagy points out that you probably do subconsciously, and I notice female therapists do it a little better than male therapists, which is with the small muscles in your face, reflect back a second order representation of the affect states of the patient, if that makes sense. Like you literally are – it's not mirroring. It's you're reflecting an appreciation without contagion. You're like, if they're sad, your face, the small muscles of the corner of the mouth and the corner of the eyes kind of reflect it. And it's, I think women do that automatically. I think it's something that it's the important exchange that goes on between moms and babies. Men can do it. We can do it, but we have to really muscle it a little bit, and we become better at it with time. But do you know what I'm talking about? Does that make sense to you?
For sure. I think especially with, virtual therapy being so popular now, that's really the majority of what I do. I'm quite conscious of how my face is coming across because that is the majority of the body language that I'm showing.
Yes.
In the session.
Yes. That's interesting. Sinus pain, congestion, heaviness in the face, and, maxillary fullness, watery eyes, headaches. Runny nose, over-the-counter prescription medication has side effects. Corticosteroid sprays, chronic steroids, do you really want to do that? Well, I'm here to tell you about a new product that might change your life. Introducing Tyvek ClearUp, an easy-to-use, FDA-approved medical device that fits in the palm of your hand. Created by physicians and neuroscientists, Tyvek ClearUp stops suffering by using bioelectric technology to reduce sinus pain and congestion. You simply glide Tyvek ClearUp on areas of your face where you're experiencing the sinus pain. Try Tyvek ClearUp today with a 60-day risk-free trial. Go to Tyvek Health, that is TIVICHELTH, Tyvek Health, just like it sounds, TyvekHealth.com, and enter the promo code DREW22. That's DREW22, and you'll receive $20 off plus free shipping on your first ClearUp device. Tyvek ClearUp works when nothing else can. Our friend Jordan Harbinger, we love him. He's a great guy, smart guy, broad life experience, speaks multiple languages. He himself has been held hostage more than once. Who can say that? And the Jordan Harbinger Show is a podcast you should be listening to. Named one of Apple's best of 2018, aims at making you better informed, more critical thinker. Each episode is a conversation with a fascinating guest. We can tell you about... Look, a cinematographer who discovered a lost city in the jungle and made one of the most important archaeological finds of the century. That's just one of the – how about an FBI negotiator who offers techniques on how to get people to like and trust you? Interesting. Useful, right? Jordan is always focused on getting useful, practical insights out of his guests. We enjoy Jordan Harbinger. I think you will too. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Maybe you've been thinking about a backyard makeover. Well, think about this idea. Michael Phelps Swim Spa by Master Spas. It comes in a variety of sizes to complement almost any backyard. Of course, the water buoyancy relieves pressure if you've got some older family members that need some water exercise. It's a great way to do it. And of course, you can exercise more vigorously with the Michael Phelps Swim Spas as well. They're 100% made in the USA by Master Spas, the world's largest swim spa manufacturers. You're going to love the Michael Phelps Swim Spa by Master Spas. Go to masterspas.com. Put in the promo code DREW to save $1,000 on a Michael Phelps Swim Spa or $500 on a Master Spas hot tub. That is masterspas.com, promo code DREW. Well, we're all going to win a trip these holidays, no doubt. Important to take a second and be prepared for the unexpected. A great way is Air Medcare Network Fly You Home membership. AMCN Fly You Home is all about taking control of your care. If you're hurt or sick or hospitalized more than 150 nautical miles from home, they will transport you to a hospital of your choice in a medically equipped private aircraft, and you won't have to pay a dime out of pocket. They have completed more than 18,000 missions and 30 years of experience. You can expect industry-leading care while recovering. Now, I know what you're thinking. This must be expensive. But it is as cheap as $134 a year for your entire household. And if you use the code Dr. Drew, that's DRDREW, they'll give you up to a $60 gift card when you join. That's so effective and so efficient. It's so cost efficient.
For those of you like me that like moving around, I cannot recommend enough the peace of mind you will feel with an AMCN Fly You Home membership. Just visit airmedcarenetwork.com/Dr. Drew today and get up to a $60 gift card with code Dr. Drew. Again, that is airmedcarenetwork.com/Dr. Drew and code Dr. Drew.
So you're validating my belief that these facial musculature sort of reflections are what that one patient was talking about who said it was so helpful. You were giving back, you were holding and then giving back their own emotions so they could metabolize it. You were sort of metabolizing it with them. But this does bring up the other issue, which is two bodies in space exchange a lot of information as well on sort of weird levels that are uncanny. Do you lose that in some of the virtual visits?
So it's interesting. At the beginning, I felt that way. And then now the more that I've done it, I think some of that is lost and so many other things are gained that I notice clients are much more comfortable in their own spaces. They're more relaxed. They attend appointments more frequently. That I wonder like what the difference is, you know, between what's being gained and lost.
So ideally you do both, really.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So down to that exchange of uncanny bodily based exchanges, people that, including myself, that have either been the object of this kind of work or who do this kind of work as a therapist, all have uncanny stories about information or experiences in the setting of the holding frame of therapy. Anything you can share with us?
Like any experiences that are interesting?
Like you hear music that you've never heard before and it's meaningful to the patient, or you get a feeling in a certain part of your body that's not yours. You kind of know it's not yours and you bring it into the room and the patient says, yeah, well, that's my dad used to kick me. Anyway, my experience is when you bring those extremely deep exchanges into the room, it's so matter of fact to the patient. They'll just sort of, they don't go, how did you know? They just go, yeah, that's that thing. And anyway, so it's like, whoa.
Yeah.
How did I experience that?
Right. I've definitely had more of those types of experiences, maybe when doing EMDR with
clients.
Yes,
that makes sense.
Where
that makes sense.
I notice that they move in a certain way and like their eyes are closed and it's an involuntary type of movement.
Yeah.
Or sometimes I get thoughts with a client where I'll say like, I'm just thinking about this and yes. It brings us on a tangent
yes.
of something from their childhood.
That's the kind of stuff I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Cause I will occasionally hear music. Then I'm like, why am I hearing that? That's not my music. I don't know what that is. Or I'll feel something, or I'll smell something, or again, I'll think something. And usually it's a really an art form to bring that in. Cause then you got to go, there's probably something really here. When do I bring that into the room? And sometimes right. I've had people storm out when I brought it into the room, but then they come back with the, how did you know stuff. But if it's, mm-hmm. if it is sort of, brought in more judiciously, they'll usually just move right on. Like, yeah, that's my thing. Anyway.
Right.
It's weird, right? I don't know.
It is.
Yeah. This, and everyone has those stories that have been in these deeper experiences. I think it's our autonomic mm-hmm. nervous system. I think it is, you know, we have these sure. giant webs over our chest and our abdomen. We have no idea what they're doing. They're huge bundles of nervous tissue that have always been sort of dismissed as, well, that's your autonomic nervous system. You know, it's the parasympathetic system is regulating your gut mobility and stuff. Nah, bullshit. It's informing the brain somehow. It's mm-hmm. giving us stuff. And I suspect it has some sort of perceptive exchange on some weird level with the other bodies. It's very weird. You're nodding.
It is very weird. It's so interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I feel like we're going to continue to learn so much about how that impacts us.
Yeah.
Over time.
How is the book being received? Are people pushing back on this? Or because it is kind of a is an entrenched notion that people have. Positive.
It is.
Be positive.
You know, it's funny. I started talking about toxic positivity online like 4 years ago, and it became a book from there. And I always have gotten pushback of like, this is so stupid. Positivity can't be toxic. People hate the word toxic. Especially when I tried to connect it to like larger themes in the world, people are like, whoa, that's nuts.
Give me an example. Give me an example of one of those themes.
So I have connected it to, you know, like how we treat people with disabilities, how positivity is used in healthcare, the way we talk about race and racism and sexism, that we always are trying to put a positive spin on everything. And there's some people that I think when they hear that stuff, it threatens their like, well, I'm just trying to be nice, like sensibility. And it creates a lot of defensiveness in my experience.
You know, there's a whole world of positive psychology, right? Are they pushing back on you? It's interesting to me that every enthusiast I've ever met for positive psychology ends up somewhere else. They end up kind of abandoning it, and they like it. They still think it was useful, but they don't – not that useful. But are those people coming after you?
So what's very funny is when I was researching for this book, I decided to not really like attack positive psychology in any way as a means for my thesis.
Yeah.
And when my book was about to come out, there was like three huge articles that came out in like The Atlantic, something else from positive psychology, saying that now they wanted to embrace the negative side of our emotions.
Oh, interesting.
And it was this whole twist in kind of what I had read throughout all my research was an over-reliance on positivity and complete dismissal of the negative. So it seems like there's a shift going on within the culture of a lot of these communities, even within self-help and, you know, the people that really make their money off of that positive thinking.
Yeah.
It's sort of going out of fashion is how I see it.
Well I'm going to tell you that they're changing because it didn't have the utility they thought it did. It didn't work. It's not useless. It's kind of a nice construct. I like it, and I've always sort of supported it, but it's not very useful, at least not in today's world. The other thing I was thinking about that's the corollary of this, which is the sort of cognitive piece of it, which is slightly different, which is, you know, think not depressed, be not depressed. You know, there's that world of your thoughts, your feelings will follow your thoughts, which is like kind of true at times, but really also deeply problematic, in my opinion. Not that people shouldn't try it, and some people might get great utility from it, but in terms of it being this standard that, you know, feel happy, be not depressed, it's like, have happy thoughts. What do we do with that? Because there is something to it. I mean, the positive, you know, sort of affirmative thinking is like, it's not zero, but maybe temper our expectations on it or something.
Right. What I found through like research on positive affirmations and a lot of that type of work is that it works for the people that don't really need it.
Right.
So it works for the people who have a pretty good life. You know, if we reduce everything down to just sort of like the person who has all their basic needs met, they're doing all right, they got a good job. Like, yeah, that's probably going to be enough for them.
Yeah.
But for the people who are struggling in a lot of other ways, medical conditions, things like that, it's not that simple.
Yeah. I remember, what was the famous book? You had a yellow cover. This one psychiatrist did this thing about, it was like Think Good, Feel Good or something. I forget the name.
Oh, it's like the Feeling Good Handbook?
Something like that. And they gave it to all.
Yeah, I can picture the cover.
Yeah. It's big letter, bold letters. They gave, back in the 90s and probably 2000s, they were handing it out. We had a depressive disorders unit in the psychiatric hospital where I lived. That's a Freudian slip. And that's why I practically lived there. They handed that book out to every single patient that came in the depression ward. And I remember thinking at the time, like, well, yeah, but that sure would be nice. Why are you using all these medications then if that's all they need to do is think right?
True.
Yeah.
It's certainly more complicated and nuanced than that, especially if we bring it back to talking about the nervous system and all that.
Has COVID-19 added a layer, I'm wondering, of either resistance or acceptance to what you're advocating?
I think it's added a lot of acceptance. I noticed a huge shift, particularly in online social media spaces, of people really just being like, can we like cut the BS and talk about what's actually going on and how we actually feel. And there was quite a lot of resistance to politicians, leaders, celebrities who were like, we're all in this together and everything's great. I found that people were getting very frustrated with
good.
That.
That's good. That's real. That's authentic. That's authentic. That's a back to authentic. And That's nice to hear. One of my disappointments in the whole thing was that we didn't have more end of life conversations and, you know, talk about, you know, aging and think, what do we want? I mean, because the whole conversation about this being primarily something that took old people away, we didn't get the advantage of having the conversation about how do we want to age? Do we want to ever be in a nursing home? If we're debilitated, how far do we want to go? You know, and everybody should have their own script for that. But for me, I kept saying, hey, no nursing home. I'm not going – if I'm so far gone that I need somebody to wipe my ass, turn me, and feed me, no nursing home. And do you know what the average life expectancy for a male in that condition is in a nursing home? It's 6 months. It's 6 months. So why do that? Why do that? Even if it goes a couple years, forget it. Palliative care, fine, good. COVID-19, fine, whatever. Just let me be. It is, you know, it used to be called the old man's friend pneumonia, and it was these kinds of infections that took people throughout history. I mean, that's it. Now, I'm not downplaying the seriousness of the pandemic and that we had a big problem on our hands, a nasty illness, which we handled rather well, by the way. We should feel pretty good about it. But other than the excesses that caused more trouble than solved, let me step away from that for a second and talk about philosophy for a second. At the very beginning of this conversation, I mentioned Aristotle. I have found that, you know, when you get deep into this material, as you clearly are, you sort of hit the limits of our professions. And philosophy becomes kind of a meaningful phenomenon. And that's kind of why specifically I brought up a good life, which is really more a philosophical concept than a psychological concept. Have you found philosophy to be useful for you in the – not just the application, but in sort of thinking about your work? And if so, what philosophical frame do you sort of rely on?
So it's interesting because – philosophy is not something that I have done a lot of work with throughout my life, throughout my professional career, but it's something that a lot of people have brought up to me after reading my book and have talked a lot about like stoicism and things like that, that now I'm just starting to kind of get in to my own learning about that because people have brought it to me saying they've been reminded of it through toxic positivity.
I'm going to give you a recommendation. There's a podcast called the because I find that clinicians that are really doing the hard work of change for humanity, for humans, you end up in philosophy. You end up needing some philosophy. And for me, it's particularly around just what is leading a good life and, you know, what does it mean to be a good person and these kinds of things. You know, what are we doing here? And there's a podcast, go ahead and write it down. It's called The Partially Examined Life. Yeah, The Partially Examined Life. And in there, they've got hundreds and hundreds of pods there. These are four or five brilliant dudes that have read, are exquisite readers of philosophy and are highly trained in it, although are not doing philosophy professionally, but sort of feel like it's a very important part of accessing the human condition. And the earlier ones, like their first 100 or so, they go over the basics. And you can get Aristotle and Plato and the Stoics and maybe some Hume and some – it depends how far you want to go. But you really need those basic, basic, basics. And it really all goes back to the Greeks. I would argue in the work that we do, not so much Plato, not so much, even though all the philosophers rely on Plato. It's more Aristotle and the Stoics. It's not an accident the Stoics come to mind for people when they're reading their stuff. And in a way, Stoics had sort of their own kind of philosophical cognitive behavioral therapy. It's sort of a CBT of sorts. But it is about and people argue it's not even a philosophy. It's just how to lead your life, which is kind of what we're talking about. You know, how to lead a good life, right? How to be a good person.
For sure.
And we've kind of lost track of all that. That's the other thing. It feels so important now because nobody's thinking about it, or at least I take it back. Thanks to Ryan Holiday and some of these other writers, Stoicism has a massive renaissance right now. And so people are beginning to think about it, but they're just beginning. They're just beginning. It should be part of everyday life, and we just don't have it so much in there. Well, listen, Whitney, it has been a privilege to talk to you. What else? What have I missed? What do you want to talk? What do you want people to be left with? And what will make them go read Toxic Positivity?
I think anyone who has ever felt like they need to suppress their emotions or like there's something wrong with them for feeling how they're feeling could really benefit from this work. And my motto, as we've talked about, is really just to live a life that's meaningful to you and that makes sense to you.
You're gonna love the Stoics. And so
can't wait. I wrote this down. I'll let you know how it goes.
Yeah, they're really, I actually did a couple, I guessed it on a couple of their pods. It was quite
cool.
Really like it was very much ultimate experience stuff for me. I really enjoyed working with those guys. Yeah. They're such good readers of philosophy. I'm so like humbled by the way they penetrate really difficult material. All right. Well, I think, as Howard Stern always says, you've said it all. We've talked about what a meaningful life is, what toxic positivity is doing to us, what we think we ought to be doing perhaps, and I want to be really clear about this. It's up to you. And I don't mean you, Whitney. I mean you, the listener. It's your life to live as you wish to. And, people, I don't think are happy in the sense of eudaimonic happiness, and think more about good life, good person, and what that means. And again, the word good is all too narrow. A meaningful life. I would think Whitney would agree with that. Mm. A meaningful existence.
Yes.
The book is Toxic Positivity, Keeping It Real in a World Obsessed with Being Happy. And you understand now maybe what we think of as happy being a term that is woefully poorly understood. Instagram at sitwithwit, website sitwithwit, WHIT.com. And if people can be an online patient of yours, right? If they go to collabcounseling.com?
Yes, I provide virtual therapy for people who live in the state of Florida.
Oh, just in Florida. So the way the licensing yes. goes now, you can't go outside. God, that's pathetic.
Gotta be in Florida.
That is,
yeah,
is that unique? Now, during COVID, I know physicians, we were able to go across state lines pretty liberally. Is that all in class?
It's still very state specific on that. And I've tried to just kind of keep it to Florida, but I know there's some stuff in the works to start making it more, countrywide.
It needs to be. It's really, frankly, disgusting. Agreed. Disgusting limiting the access to care. So that's not good.
Yeah.
All right, Whitney, thank you so much. And everyone else, we will see you next time.
For call-in times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's D-R-D-R-E-W Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the Swingin' Sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. All conversation and information exchanged during the participation in the Dr. Drew Podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction. Nothing on these podcasts supplement or supersede the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the podcast or drdrew.com.
All this month, stream the funniest films for free on Pluto TV. Watch comedy classics like Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy, and Mean Girls. Or drop in for a Tyler Perry marathon with a Madea family funeral and Madea's witness protection. Pluto TV also has hundreds of channels and thousands of movies and TV shows like Get Shorty, Be Cool, Key and Peele, Comedy in Color, and more. And no contracts, no subscriptions, no fees, no joke. So download the Pluto TV app on your favorite streaming device and start laughing today. Pluto TV, drop in, watch free.
On the Jordan Harbinger Show, you'll hear amazing stories from people that have lived them, from spies to CEOs, even an undercover agent who infiltrated the Gambino crime family. You're about to hear a preview of the Jordan Harbinger Show with Jack Garcia, who did just that.
My career was 24 out of 26 years was solely dedicated working undercover. I walk in, I'm in the bar. Now, there's a barmaid there, good-looking young lady. She's serving me drinks. Hey, what would you like? My drink was, give me a Kettle One martini, three olives, glass of water on the side. I finish the drink. The guys come in. I'm going to go in my pocket, take out the big wad of money. Bam, I give her $100. If you're with the mob, I say, hey, Jordan, you're on record with us. That means we protect you. Nobody could shake you down. We could shake you down. but you're on record with us.
For more on how Jack became so trusted in the highest levels of the Gambino organization, check out episode 392 of The Jordan Harbinger Show.
Who doesn't love a classic chocolate chip cookie? Famous Amos has been making them since the 70s, 1975 to be exact. With semi-sweet chocolate chips and a satisfying crunch, it's everything classic in one bite-sized cookie. And fans couldn't get enough. That's right. You'll find our original recipe, the one you know and love, in every bag of Famous Amos original chocolate chip cookies. Find Famous Amos anywhere you buy your favorite snacks.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than a life policy. It's about the promise and the responsibility that comes with being a new parent. Being there day and night. And building a plan for tomorrow, today. For the ones you'll always look out for, trust Amica Life Insurance. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.